Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 4th of April, 12 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Joe Bonilla has a sheaf of papers in front of him, and I'm dying to ask him, are those all your notes for the show, are you working on another project?
No, I mean, there's always plenty of projects, but I have a couple of notes I always do right before the show, therefore I'm caught up, and especially if Teresa's here, too, so I want to make sure I'm not, got to bounce that a little bit.
Teresa hides it better because she has it all in her lap.
That's right.
Yeah. I started on paper, but then I had to switch to
Go digital.
Yeah, I had to go digital.
Well, we have a wonderful panel assembled this morning. I think we have some good topics to discuss, so we'll get right to it and find out what's happening in the world. Alan Chartok is here. He's checking the news of the day. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I am, and I'm just checking my mail.
Yeah.
And I'm
good?
You're very festive today, Alan.
Oh, I am festive. I'm a festive occasion.
Is it you?
My band, The Satellites for Music Out of This World.
Yes.
When I was a young man.
Yes.
And
is that the shirt you wore?
No, but it said on our card, which is an Art Deco card for weddings, bar mitzvahs, and all festive occasions.
All festive occasions. And you have a Western shirt on today.
I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's quite festive and it's quite an occasion.
It involves rivets.
Yeah.
It's like pattern with a little sunshine.
Little rivets.
Huh.
If you want to see this, you can tune us in on our web streaming.
The district attorney for the county of Albany, David Soares, is here. Would you like to comment on the president's charge?
Yes, you're under arrest.
I actually came in here with a subpoena and search warrants looking to remove from the premises any shirts that look like that.
Yeah. You've come to the right place.
1940s. I think you have a model coming on later. It's a fashion model.
Yeah, we have Tyra Banks coming on later.
So maybe, Alan's getting ready.
That's right. David Soares, good morning. Very nice to have you here as always. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
We should mention Jen Smith, who usually joins us on Wednesdays, as David likes to say it, part of our Berkshire Mafia. She is under the weather and not able to join us today, but we wish her well and hope she'll be feeling better soon. Joe Bonilla is filling in today, and we're thrilled to have him with us. He's a communications consultant and the busiest man in Albany, and we're thrilled to have you here.
Always great to be here.
Thank you very much. Teresa Bourgeois joins us. She is a communications consultant and joins us several times in a week, and we're thrilled to have her today.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you. All right. Let's get started. Oh, by the way, I just want to make mention of the roundtable panel climate change discussion is on April 20th. And tickets are going very, very fast, which is lovely. And we just want to remind you that if you want tickets, now's the time to get them. Judith Eng, Jeff Goodell, Elizabeth Colbert, and Terry Tempest Williams. That's our super panel. EPA regional administrator, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Eng, best-selling author, Rolling Stone contributing editor, Jeff Goodell. Elizabeth Colbert, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her climate writing in The Sixth Extinction, and Terry Tempest Williams, who is a wonderful naturalist, activist, writer, best-selling author, and also the writer-in-residence at Harvard Divinity School. All will be on one stage at Page Hall, April 20th, which is Earth Day weekend. It's going to be a live broadcast of the roundtable from Page Hall from 9 to 11. Tickets are free. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org. WAMC.org.
The timing here couldn't be any more perfect than what it is. I mean, with everything that's happening with the EPA and Scott Pruitt right now, for you to have the line up that kind of talent on one stage, I can imagine what that discussion is going
to be. I sort of wish you hadn't brought that up, because actually we were gonna do it over at the Linda, and then Scott Pruitt said, "I have this really cool condo I can put you in." And we
$50 a night.
That's right. And we were like, "Hey, man, we'll take it. It's bigger." So, but we ended up at the State University, and we're thrilled about that. So, yeah. Anyway, WAMC.org. The tickets are there. You'll see it on the right hand side of the page, and just click, and you can get your tickets. And we'll Eventbrite it. It'll print out an actual ticket for you to show up on the 20th and join us for a very special occasion. So WAMC.org.
As Judith was talking about, and you mentioned too, not just discussing what the problem is, but talking about solutions, which I think will be very interesting.
We are going to try to keep it as optimistic as possible. We'll see how we do. Okay, let's go to what is happening in the world and begin with the president's comments yesterday and the plans to send the National Guard to the Mexican border. The White House said Tuesday night that President Trump planned to deploy the National Guard to the southern border to confront what is called a growing threat of illegal immigrants, drugs, and crime from Central America after the president, for the third consecutive day, warned about the looming dangers of unchecked immigration. Mr. Trump's advisors said Monday that he was readying new legislation to block immigrants and asylum seekers, including young unaccompanied children, for entering the United States, opening a new front in the immigration crackdown that he pressed since taking office. But in remarks on Tuesday that caught some of his top advisors by surprise, how many times have we said that line in the last year?
How many times per day?
Man. In Cummins that caught his top advisors by surprise, he suggested the more drastic approach of sending in the military to do what immigration authorities could not. Speaking to reporters during a news conference with the presidents of three Baltic nations, Mr. Trump described existing immigration laws as lax and ineffective and called for militarizing the border with Mexico to prevent an influx of Central American migrants that he said were ready to stream across it. The quote, "We have horrible, horrible, and very unsafe laws in the United States."
Well, Joe, he's full of beans. We know it. But it doesn't much matter because again and again and again he plays to the base. And, you know, xenophobia is a part of that base. Now, we do know that the statistics are very extraordinary. They are that there are more people going back than coming in, that this is the lowest time of ever for immigration, of that illegal immigration, if you want to use the word illegal or undocumented. So, in other words, we are winning the war. But it doesn't matter to him because he's using it the way that he has always used things in order to reassure his election if he can.
Well, you know, this idea where you're using crime and violence as a justification for sending in military to the borders, the reality is you don't have the corresponding statistics coming from states like California, from Arizona, from Texas, that would justify that. And once again, what we have is a president who's putting a solution before his fictional problem. They should have spent a little more time trying to create the fiction and then introduce the military as a possible solution, but they've done neither very well here.
He doesn't feel he has to, David. I mean, that's the beauty of this guy. When you have basically a politically illiterate population, you can say anything you want. Somebody's going to agree with it.
That's true, and that's what's so unfortunate here. And I think I've always had confidence in our ability as a country to move forward and move away from things like this. And that confidence erodes every day when I see a person. I mean, you started off this segment by mentioning what just transpired yesterday. And you said it was a White House speech that was given at the White House. This was a speech that could have been given, you know, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, from an end of a bar stool in a place with dirty glasses, right? That's the kind of conversations you expect to hear there. It's not the kind of conversation you expect to hear from the Oval Office.
Teresa?
Well, I just want one reporter to ask the president about posse comitatus laws, because that's really what we're talking mm-hmm. about, and I wonder if he knows that.
I don't know that. Go ahead.
It's the law that says in the military, you want to explain?
It's a law that states that the military can't occupy, you know, a state. And, you can't be a member of law enforcement using the military.
You can't use the military for domestic purposes. Right. So you can use the National Guard to protect in cases of disaster or whatever mm-hmm. within the United States. But our posse comitatus rules that have been in place, laws for a long, long time, say that you cannot use the military, U.S. military, domestically. And so, that being said, I wanted to see what the Military Times had to say about this. So I read the stories last night from the Military Times, and they talked about the fact that George Bush sent the National Guard to the border, and it cost for about 2 years to protect the border when there were some issues. And it was a had a price tag of about $1.2 billion and caused a lot of distraction. Now, what they did not directly intervene, but they provided assistance like infrared monitoring, such so you could see people coming across the border, and then they would alert the Border Patrol, and the Border Patrol would then go in and do the actual policing. So they didn't use them for actual policing, but for backup assistance. And the Obama administration used them for training purposes and somewhat a little bit, but nothing to the scale that what the president is talking about here. So that's one thing. Is what he's talking about even legal? Is one question.
I would also add that in the context of both previous presidents, what we had going on in the country of Mexico was an amazing drug war that was consummated as a result of one of the largest kingpins mm-hmm. being taken down that caused right. such incredible massacres along the border. And there was a tremendous fear of that spilling over into the United States.
Not economic refugees.
Not economic refugees. So there's okay. context to what was done in the past. There is no context to what's being right. done now.
And the other thing is this notion of the caravan's coming. It just is so disgusting to use people this way. You know, I've been reading about what this quote-unquote caravan is, and this, you know, he got that off of Fox News, and I'm sure this is very helpful. He was at Mar-a-Lago this weekend with a bunch of Fox people, and, you know, this, I'm sure, helps raise his poll numbers, which is part of what he wants to do. But he's using the human suffering of these very poor people to try to raise his poll numbers.
This is an annual migration
of workers who come out of Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, and they come up primarily into Mexico, and they work in Mexico, and some of them come across to the United States, and then they go back. It happens every year. And now they are stopped in a soccer field, you know, 300 children. There are about 1,000 of them. And many of them were not bound for the United States. But he creates this fiction. And there's real lives, real struggling people who would probably come over to pick our crops, you know. And so it's really sad. It's just sad.
Well,
it's this perpetual disdain and now institutionalized way of just total disrespect to anybody who lives, you know, south of the border or south of the Gulf. We saw the president's comments against Honduras. We saw the president's comments about Mexico from the very beginning of his campaign in June 2015. We saw the president's actions in Puerto Rico. So it seems like anybody beneath that line earns no respect. Now, whether it is to shore up any sort of domestic notion that, you know, he wants to create folks who are a little bit, you know, darker than him, you know, as his boogeyman to raise up the base and obviously look to shore up, you know, whatever Republican chances are in the midterms, that remains to be seen. But it's, again, this perpetual and now institutionalized disrespect of folks from Central America and the Caribbean.
What about the folks from my continent, the S-hole continent?
Oh, well, again, your guys are right in the same mix.
I don't think that he shows us any love.
No.
And you think about, I hate to make this analogy, but at Germany, you know, and what Hitler did, you know, the Jews were the other, right? Mm-hmm. And just this creating this class of the other that we have to be fearful of.
You have to dehumanize.
And dehumanizing right. them. Well, we've got to find a way to fight back against this. This is just not what we are as a country.
I was going to use the word fear-mongering, and that's exactly what's going on here. And it is intensified over the last several days. I mean, it's always been there on the baseline, right, with this president. But it seems in this particular case with the migrant caravan, which is a term I don't really like using, but that seems to be what we're seeing.
But economic uncertainty is always going to create that in the masses, right? When you look at what happened after World War I, right, and the Treaty of Versailles that placed such, you know, one would say grotesque burdens on the people of Germany. That's what allowed for a leader like that to arrive at a stage and then to convince a whole nation of people to support the endeavor of mass extermination. We see the same, you know, elements here where you're seeing people whose livelihood are being changed through automation. We see people throughout the states that he's won in the Rust Belts whose economic future is certainly uncertain. He's able to use the others and to leverage them and leverage their support, but also to just be with him as he's engaging in this vitriolic rhetoric. And from the pulpit of the United States White House, right. A house he couldn't describe this week.
Oh, right. That was terrible. Yeah. And to blame immigrants for these economic woes. And also, you wonder, well, why are people leaving Honduras? Why are they leaving El Salvador? And in the past, in theory, you know, there's violence there. Where are the guns coming from? You know, what can you do about that? Do we have any effort to try to help those countries deal with the gun violence that they're suffering? And there's economic insecurity there, incredible economic security. Yet at the State Department, they've shut down most of the programs, and they don't have the people who in other times would work with those countries to try to shore up and try to help stabilize them. You think about all this NAFTA rhetoric about it's all us. We don't care about these other countries. And so what is he doing? What's the U.S. policy now to try to help, you know, stem the flow of folks? Because, to help to have more economic stability where they are and less gun violence where they are.
What we have right now in our world, and there's a reason that since World War II we've engaged in a global endeavor. We've looked to enrich the lives of people where they are, so people can stay where they are. And when you have violence and war that break out in nations, you will have a refugee crisis. And that's what we're seeing happening right now all over the world. And so this idea that we can once again become isolationists without ever having to deal with the consequences of such a ridiculous philosophy is absurd. I think Germany, Italy, you know, the entire Eastern Europe, all the Eastern Europe nations right now are feeling the effects of what's happening in the Middle East as a result of the destabilization. And this idea now that we're also going to be pulling out of Afghanistan and we're going to just abandon Syria and we're just going, it's just really absurd.
And huge arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And huge arms sales. And what are we doing in Syria? What are we doing in Syria? Alan, you know, what are we doing in Syria, as you just said, to cause people to leave, which then is further destabilizing Europe? What are we doing? How many refugees out of Yemen? And, you know, we are complicit in what's going on in Yemen.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla, David Soares, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue. We'll go to letters when we come back. We'll talk more about this issue, talk about the migrant caravan, also China tariffs. We want to talk about Amazon, of course, also talk about Martin Luther King on the 50th anniversary of his assassination. All that and more after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla, David Soares, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. Alan has a couple. Let's do those, then we'll move on.
Okay, Chief. Military to the border. As terrible as it is up front that Trump is talking about military deployment to deal with these massive hordes of immigrants coming over the border, I find it very, in capital letters, scary that our leader is now wanting to deploy the military domestically and for law enforcement. As people are frightened as I are people as frightened as I am about the optics of this relationship to other authoritative governments. I think instead of the word authoritative, I would use authoritarian.
Well, I would also, you know, caution us here before we completely leap off the edge that I believe that he is truly looking to pull some resources out of our military budget in order to get his wall. And what better way to do that than create this false notion that we need military?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
We need the military along our southern borders. And by the way, you know, if we don't really want the military there anymore because it's costing too much, let's have the military build
also
a wall.
this false, and it is a false notion, right? That he keeps on saying, he said it again yesterday that the work has already begun.
It's
the
not
work
true.
Has already begun on the wall, and that isn't true. No. But he keeps saying that.
Correct.
So you put those two together, and I agree with you.
Right.
Yeah. It's correct that he keeps saying it. It's not correct what he's saying. But, Alan, at the beginning of that letter, it talked about hordes of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I really want to take exception to the notion that hordes of people are coming over. There are about 1,000 to 1,200 people in this so-called, quote-unquote, caravan. Most of them were not headed to the United States. Most of them are headed to Mexico. And, in fact, movements across the border are down. I was looking for the number.
I said so before, dramatically.
Right. So this notion, the writer, with all due respect, thank you for writing, but it's not hordes of people.
Well, I think there's probably being a little facetious there.
No question, David.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No question. This was tongue-in-cheek.
I apologize. Then. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't.
That's okay.
Teresa's an anti-hoarder. She's called it the
word. No, this whole notion of demonizing these people.
We've got a lot of peanut butter on our shelf.
Hoarding people.
No. Yeah. our friend Rocco says, resident of the White House, panel, when are people going to realize that the current resident of the White House is insane? Every decision and every appointment that he makes has been designed to destroy more and more of this country. I am concerned that he could declare an emergency, in quotes, and rescind posse comitatus. At that point, he could have military everywhere. He could also suspend elections because of his created, quote, emergency. He certainly is building up an awful lot of military in his administration. Now, with Social Security and other chicken hawk warmonger, we should really... Oh, now with the Social Security advisor, another...
National Security Advisor, it must mean.
He must mean National Security. You are so right. I corrected you a minute before, and now you've had your revenge.
Balance.
Teresa. You're exactly right.
Balance has been restored.
I'm sure you were looking for revenge.
I was just trying to help.
I agree with that. I was trying to be funny. I guess I wasn't. Now...
But the peanut butter thing is very funny. I'm still laughing about that.
Now, with a security advisor, another chicken hawk warmonger, we really should be worried that a war will be declared to create a diversion to take us back to an era before the U.S. Revolution. It says where, but I think it's where. Donnie is king, and everyone else is his subject. And that's from... Take care, Rocco in Rosendale.
Rocco, my concern here is the fact that whatever controls may have existed in the White House prior to a month ago, they're gone, as evidenced by the chaotic nature that we've seen an increase of over the course of the last 2 weeks. So whoever used to be there controlling this man is no longer there.
They were held by a string, but then the string's gone.
The string's gone. But yeah. What's more offensive to me is that, you know, you have an entire body within the construct of our democracy that is supposed to hold the president in check, and they have completely failed the American people, and that's our Congress.
And you don't see Kelly, by the way, as that person in the White House.
What's interesting?
Kelly's position, I don't know if you've noticed this, but over the course of the last month, I mean, he's faded into the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just seems to me, I have no proof about this, but it seems to me after Rob Porter left that things really, and then Hope Hicks announced that she was leaving and now is gone. It may be that Rob Porter did institute a fair amount of the discipline there in support of Kelly. And because since he's left, there seems to be a lot more chaos.
Well, there was a news item, Teresa, a couple of days ago, maybe a week ago, that said the president is saying he wants Porter back.
Right. Probably other people there want him back too. But in terms of that letter, one of the things that's interesting is that he's referencing John Bolton, as the National Security Advisor, I want somebody to ask him what his thoughts are on what Trump said about Syria. and pulling out of Syria, and because he is, you know, he would be for more troops to Syria,
and
right?
So,
he
yes,
would be for bombing Syria. So
that's right.
How is that going to work when his national security advisor is completely, he said, I want people who think the way I do. And then, you know, clearly he and his national security advisor won't be on the same page on that one.
And yesterday there was a real embarrassment, I think, because the president said one thing, let's get out of Syria, and his designated head of the Syrian whole thing was saying, no, we're going to stay there till it's done.
He was giving, at the same time, giving a talk at the War College, no, actually not the War College, the Peace Institute. Really wrong.
Same place.
Yeah. It's right across the hall.
Oh, my
right.
goodness, Teresa. And exactly right, Alan, saying completely contradicting.
Okay, so now John writes, conservative groups I'm part of online strongly feel that the liberal desire to see more immigration from South American nations is due to the goal of padding liberal votes, not kindness. I must agree. I must say I agree, because if the left-wing media cared so much for humanitarian issues, then they would have given far more extensive coverage to the displacement of South African farmers.
I don't even know where to begin with that. I don't know where he was trying to go there, because if the premise of the note is that the liberals are looking for more immigrants to come in just so we can pad the votes. The votes are there
right.
in terms of a liberal agenda. It's just that you don't have people voting.
Yeah.
And that obviously is a common theme, that you want more immigrants because they can then vote and they'll vote for Democrats. And but, again, let me go back to where are the efforts to try to help stabilize so that people can stay in Honduras, so that people can stay in El Salvador,
right.
so that they can remain in their countries, home countries, with their families? Because that's the best situation. The best situation is that Yemenis stay in Yemen, that Syrians stay in Syria, that Hondurans stay in Honduras, so on and so forth. But that takes a global effort to stop. You know, what are we doing in this country to stop the demand for drugs that's putting pressure in Mexico?
And I want to say one other thing, and that is that the letter writer, of course, says padding the vote, but these folks can't vote. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Not really,
right,
no.
Right. But it is a common theme. If you listen to Fox News, this is a very common theme.
Well, it may be a common theme. It's just wrong.
Well, it's fact-free. And you know, we're now living in an age of fact-free news, you know, as evidenced by Sinclair and the nonsense that's being perpetrated, you know, in smaller, you know, media markets all throughout the globe. But going back to your point, Teresa, you know, there's really three things that can destabilize a nation, right? I mean, you can have natural disasters, you can have famine, you know, you can have, you know, war. You can also have economic stability. And I would argue that right now, what we're seeing happening throughout the world, because our economies are inextricably intertwined, is you're seeing economic destabilization. Economic destabilization that's going to be brought on and exacerbated by the fact that you have a mercantile philosophy in a president of the United States who believes that trade wars are easy to win and has now begun to unilaterally, strike against the most powerful nations, not to mention our own allies.
And by the way, the history of trade wars is disaster.
Is disaster.
Right. Not the best checkered history.
Is disaster.
But I want to make one point about immigration. I know Teresa was talking about, like, obviously folks staying in their same countries, but at the same time, we need to make it much more clearer for folks who do want to enter the country
right.
and provide a real path to citizenship. I have so many friends, and no matter where they're from, it could be from Japan, from Western Europe, it can be from the Caribbean, and for how much it takes and the effort and the years and the money for them to go through the process, it's truly heartbreaking, where folks are here in this country for 10, 20 years, and they're deported after 20 years.
Right.
And
they've been trying.
They've been trying the right way.
Proper channels. Right. Right. Right.
And so we have to do something about that to move that forward.
And by the way, I have to say that one of the reasons that we are seeing this progressive area of people staying, not coming to the United States and going back to Mexico, has been that Obama followed that exact prescription that you guys are laying out. In other words, he said we've got to intervene in those home countries and that's what will keep them there. And most of the progress we made was done during the Obama administration.
There was a fascinating article yesterday in Politico, Foreign Visas Plunge Under Trump, and it talked about the U.S. has granted 13% fewer visitor visas in the past 12 months. It talks about how difficult it is, particularly for certain countries,
right,
for people to get here, how people are left in limbo. There was a heartbreaking... And what negative impact that is having on our colleges and universities, on business, and so on and so forth, on travel. People spent 3.3% less on travel, according to this. That's a $4.6 billion loss, 40,000 jobs, you know. So these decisions all have tremendous economic impact. And NPR, who has been, the PBS NewsHour, has been doing an incredible job covering Yemen. You know, I'm a little fixated on Yemen. They were talking about refugees from there. Many of them have U.S. citizenship, maybe a son or a daughter, and the wife has citizenship, the husband doesn't. And they have been stuck in limbo now for a year, 2 years, trying to get back into the country because since Trump's command, people can't move like they had in the past.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have more letters. We'll go into the subjects. We welcome your... thoughts, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion. Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla. We also have Teresa Bourgeois and David Swords with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Alan has a couple.
I do. Regular writer Robert writes us, a legal pod in New York State. According to the New York Times, Cynthia Nixon is proposing to legalize recreational marijuana in New York State if she's elected. Please, David Soares, give us your view on this issue, particularly in light of its becoming legal in Massachusetts.
Well, you know, the challenge that we have right now as a state of New York is how do we deal with recreational marijuana, especially how do we deal with it now in the context of so many of our states and neighboring states, legalizing recreational marijuana. We can take the position of the status quo, which means we're going to have an influx of it and we're going to be powerless to really stop it. I mean, even when the Golden Coast of California, past recreational marijuana, medicinal marijuana, we were seeing incredible imports of the product here on our streets. And so, I think I can speak for most members of law enforcement, and I engage in with this conversation, that, you know, the age of us believing that this was a gateway drug, those days are gone. We now know better. So it's time New York takes a step. It should take a step in legalization, with the understanding that the tax revenue that flows would be put back into combating addiction in opioids and other areas of addiction that causes a lot of problems.
But part of the issue, obviously, is that because of the federal challenges with obviously financial institutions handling marijuana, you would have to have folks that can handle a lot of cash, not necessarily using a bank.
Listen, and here is the thing, right? The decisions being made right now by the Department of Justice, specifically AG Sessions, right, is putting people at risk. I've been out to Seattle and I've watched, their operations, right? And the biggest challenge for an operation like that is the cash flow. Right. They literally have to time the pickup and delivery of dollars in ways that will keep people from being able to detect a pattern,
right,
in order to protect the lives of the people that are engaged in this transport. And so by the Department of Justice taking this position, it is placing people who run these shops at risk. Because marijuana, for me, the only problems I have with marijuana in Albany County are the home invasions that are perpetrated in weed houses right here. But if it were to be legalized...
Illegal weed houses.
Right.
But if it were to be legalized, then you wouldn't have, home invasions that are accompanied by weapons, that are accompanied by extreme violence. And so the idea that the Department of Justice continues to take this position, especially when it comes to banking, it's almost like they're courting or inviting home invasions on you know, legal proprietors.
Okay, but just for the sake of devil's advocacy, because as you know, Shartouk means little devil. Yeah, that's right. So, so my question then is, every once in a while you'll see a story about somebody crashing a car somewhere and they find, you know, loads of marijuana in the car and the person had imbibed. I suppose you could say the same thing for alcohol and worse.
We have a problem even with Uber, even with Lyft, even with apps, even with cell phones that everyone has. You have people that cannot exercise, you know, proper judgment, and they're going to go out there and consume alcohol and put other people's lives at risk, right? The only way that I would ever, you know, see myself fully endorsing a proposition where, you know, we're legalizing recreational use is what we decide to do with the tax dollars. The tax dollars has to be put back into greater enforcement, greater road patrol, so that we're ensuring that we have security on the roads. You'd also have to, you know, take some of those dollars and put into the opioid addiction, which is by far the most clear and present danger that we have in our country today, aside from the use of handguns and or illegal guns that are out on our streets. But thirdly, you know, you've also got to put resources into workforce development, especially for youth who are in one of those communities right now that struggle with, you know, the kind of crimes that the illicit drug economy brings in. So those are my clearly staked out positions on the discussion of marijuana legalization. But, you know, you're looking at Vermont, you're looking at New Hampshire, you're looking at Massachusetts, you're looking at New Jersey. So here we are. The decision that New York State has to make is either we're going to take a progressive step forward here, or we're just going to not do that and still have all the consequences of it.
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right, I think. Gail, where would you go? Dear panel, when the U.S. is complicit in destroying your country, where do you go? Many Americans are clueless as to why many people want to come here or to other countries. They can't seem to connect the dots between the U.S. destroying someone's country or helping others to destroy a country and people moving to a safer place. MLK was right when he said the U.S. is the biggest purveyor of violence in the world. Americans are in deep, deep propaganda sleep. That's from Gail. And then from Bill in Athens, who writes something. It says, the Berkshire Edge reported that Commerce Secretary billionaire Wilbur Ross is moving to the wonderful Berkshire town of Great Barrington. That's my hometown, by the way, folks. How can that be? Is this the beginning of the end for Great Barrington or the start of a transition to its becoming a bastion of corporate exceptionalism? Can I just start on that first a little bit, because I live there, and say we've had former secretaries of state and the Treasury and other people living in Great Barrington for years. What, we're going to start giving people a political litmus test before they can buy in, you know, in the town? It's ridiculous.
I thought that already existed there.
Yeah, I see. I see.
An attack on the Berkshire Mafia.
The perfect? No, I'm not attacking them.
No, of course not. Why would you?
I see. Okay, thank you,
Bill.
I'm
staying out of this one.
How come no one's starting their letters by saying good morning today?
Oh, no, I don't read them anymore.
Oh.
We were under tremendous attack from those people who say, I added up all the time. You guys kidded around about good morning. And by the time that was done, it was like 8 hours and 57 minutes. So I've been avoiding that a little bit. Okay. Martin says, history. David, are you viewing history through rose-colored glasses? American support for vicious authoritarian regimes in Central America in the 80s, especially El Salvador, led to a migration of immigrants to the United States and the formation of MS-13 in California. We are not always a force for good and have had a long history of disregarding Hispanic lives. Trump is no different, just more vocal.
I guess Manuel Noriega was better than his replacement.
Yeah, good point.
In their opinion, in the writer's opinion.
Sure. Okay, and Crystal.
But it's true. We haven't always been a force for good.
We have
but
not.
We have been a force for good. We know how to do this.
The pendulum swings back and
forth. We know how to do it. We know how to be helpful. And I wonder, in this all of this bluster about the NAFTA negotiations, is there any thought to this aspect of maintaining economic stability in those regions, you know, as part of the NAFTA negotiations? Is it? Because I don't hear Trump talking about that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hear him talking about how important it is to have the region be economically secure, not just the United States.
No, and in fact, that was the point earlier that I was trying unsuccessfully to make, obviously, the reason that there are fewer people trying to get into the country is because Obama's philosophy was to make things better, you know, in those places. And so there's that. And I love your word, bluster. What's the first thing you think of when you hear the word bluster?
Phineas.
That's right. Joe, you're a genius.
Thank you very much.
Phineas T. Bluster.
Phineas T. Bluster.
He was from the Howdy Doody show for all you younger people.
I was thinking Winnie the Pooh.
No.
Winnie the Pooh and the Blustery Day.
I was still back in West Africa when Bluster was on television.
And Crystal says, hopeful thinking. Good morning, panel. Please tell me it's true. Is there any truth that Scott Pruitt may be leaving? If so, then when?
No.
Coming under fire. I think there was an article, I believe, in the New York Times, although it could have been the Post, that said that it was eerie with Scott Pruitt because the president said that he has no danger of leaving, which is code for he's in danger of leaving.
You're right.
But he talks about it. It'll all be right. It'll be all right. It'll be great. Now, it could be great, but I think he more likely will move him.
Let me ask you this. If he does leave, is there a chance that he can be on that great panel you have coming up in April?
Invitation in the mail, man. Yeah.
Boy, those clean air, quote-unquote, the CAFE standards that, anyway, yesterday with the auto change. He's doing a lot of damage at the EPA. Other people would consider it being very effective, depending on how you like to breathe.
My question for that for that writer is: if Scott Pruitt leaves, is his replacement going to be any better? The question for me is: you know, how willing is the Congress to continue to just vote and support these nominations? That they just seem to do only several months back, right?
Right.
It seems like they were confirming these people less than a year ago.
We have to continue with the game. We were doing this earlier in your absence, where we were saying, okay, so the private doctor is the head of the VA, the pilot is FAA. So think of that in your brain as to who then would be the EPA,
the toxic Avenger. Yeah, of course, yeah.
The gardener. I don't know. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, the toxic Avenger.
New Jersey's born.
He's got to drive a Hummer, though, to work.
Each one,
well,
that's right.
Don't we all? We'll be right back after this break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are back in our 10 o'clock hour. Alan Chartok is here, Joe Bonilla, David Soares, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Let us do go to some new topics here and talk about some other stuff, and then we'll go to some letters in just a few moments. We want to talk about tariffs and China. Trump administration targets $50 billion in Chinese electronics, aerospace, and machinery goods with tariffs. China now turning around and adding to our list as well. So a lot of news being made in that regard. The Dow currently, you just told me, Teresa, was...
It dropped 500 points, but now it's now about 350, 400
it's
points.
It's bouncing so back up.
But it immediately dropped 500. Now, actually, it's just 307, so it's moving all over the place. It's been up and down in
the last hour.
And that's a pre-tweet? That's a pre-tweet figure you've given us?
So Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, was reportedly on Squawk Box trying to calm the markets and saying, "It's a we're going to win this trade war." And in response to that, the president reportedly tweeted out that we're not in a trade war, and that then caused the market to dip even further.
Great.
But it's moving around. Well, now it's going back down again.
So China hit back at the United States on Wednesday with proposed tariffs on American soybeans, cars, chemicals, and other goods in a move likely to stoke fears that the country's escalating confrontation could become an all-out trade war. So,
I think China hit back with extreme precision, because if you follow the pattern of what they actually identified, these are all the red states and the heartland and the base of one President Donald Trump.
Well, again, I'm not a trade expert in any way, shape, or form, but from what I've read, the key would be soybeans. Where if the Chinese included soybeans in the list, that meant that they meant business, and they in fact did. And the bottom fell out of the soybean overnight market last night and again today. And so this may be rhetoric, because on both sides, these are just proposed tariffs. That in the U.S. case, I think it's 30 days. In the China, they didn't set a time limit. But regardless of that, if you're a soybean farmer in Iowa or Michigan, where there are a lot of them, today you've lost a lot of money.
But haven't the retirement and pension funds of a lot of Americans.
Right.
And so these words matter. I understand that they're just threats at this point, but words do matter. And if you're the person losing a ton of money today because of the words from this president, then I don't think you're happy this morning.
You imagine if you were Tom DiNapoli, our wonderful comptroller in New York State, and you're evaluated on how your pension funds are doing, and it's gone down, let's say, 1,000 points by the time this is all over or more. That can't be a good day for you.
No. And I'll speak to at least the automaker side of it. You know, one of the biggest nameplates that's really popular in China is Buick. And for General Motors, actually, has been a weird bright spot in that market. And actually, I was just down in the New York International Auto Show. Buick is making a huge push to capture the rising middle class in China with this new upper echelon level of Buick vehicles they have. So this happening the same week.
Why is Buick so popular?
I don't understand why Buick is. But it seems to be Buick, of all the GM nameplates, whether it's Chevy or Cadillac, it's Buick that really resonates with Chinese.
Huh.
And the other is the airplanes and Boeing stock. Also, I don't know what it is right now, but I checked it earlier this morning in the overnight markets. It tanked the Boeing stock. So soybeans, cars, chemicals, airplanes. Again, I think the Chinese are playing three-dimensional chess, and I fear that Donald Trump is playing tic-tac-toe, and people will get hurt. And can I piggyback on your notion about the 401k's people's pensions? That's also true with Amazon. I was thinking about that yesterday as the president is attacking Bezos at Amazon because he doesn't like the Washington Post.
Right.
And Amazon has lost a tremendous value over the last several days because of that. Well, that also hurts the average working families who have mutual funds. And Amazon is in a lot of those mutual funds, and they're getting hurt by that, too.
In one day, went down 5%.
Right. Well, the soy prices just have dropped precipitously. I checked that a few minutes ago. The first member of Congress I worked for was a soybean farmer.
Well, the thing with Amazon that I find to be the most insidious is the fact that, his attack on this company stems from
business.
The Washington Post that is also owned by Bezos. And it's the coverage that he's receiving in the Washington Post that has inspired him to try to hurt this particular entrepreneur by making up. I mean, I think there's been more coverage to correct this man about the Postal Service and the fact that the Postal Service is actually making money from Amazon. There's been more press coverage correcting this man, and yet he insists and he keeps going at this. And of all the troubling remarks that he's made, it's targeting corporations, it's targeting individuals from the position of the presidency of the United States.
Well, let's distill it down to the ego. The reason why the president's going after Jeff Bezos, he's the world's richest man. Mm-hmm. So for someone like Donald Trump, who wants to be known as this rich and wealthy and successful person, he can't fathom having somebody like this you know, basically run circles around them.
Yeah, but I think the earlier comment that it's about the Washington Post.
Oh, of course. No, absolutely. Right now it is. Absolutely.
You remember Nixon saying nobody would ever be, no Washington Post reporter would ever be allowed during Watergate into the White House again.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but as we discussed a little earlier, Boeing was also on the receiving end of his criticism.
Early.
And you know, at first I thought, what a strange thing to be going after Boeing. But when you saw the stock market react to Boeing, I mean, they immediately, you know, came groveling back to the table after
a $4 billion deal to a $3.9 billion deal. Yeah. So for him being this great deal maker, okay, you saved $100 million.
I'm sorry, David, I didn't get that. So who came groveling back?
Boeing.
Oh, Boeing. Yeah, and who did they grovel to?
The president. The president had attacked Boeing.
President-elect, right?
It was the president-elect.
It was the president-elect.
Yeah, it was. The Air Force One.
Yeah. The cost of the refabricated, brand-new Air Force One. He didn't like the sticker price, and he attacked Boeing. Boeing had, you know, explained that, you know, things have changed and there's more technology that they're including in this plane. And after his attack, the Boeing stock had fallen, and Boeing came back with a different price. And so that strong arming of a company, which is exactly what he did in his private practice.
Right.
Teresa?
I was just going back to the China trade war, and I thought one of the quotes at the end of the Washington Post story was interesting. They said today's move is a, quote, a rising wind that foretells a storm. This is a Beijing expert, he said, adding that whether the storm comes depends on President Trump. And clearly there is a problem with the U.S. trade deficit with China. And clearly there is a problem, and Alan, you know, you and I were talking about this Monday, about intellectual property. The question is about China, you know, stealing U.S. intellectual property. The question is, what is the right way to thread the needle to handle that problem?
Well, you empower the World Trade Organization. You know, the World Trade Organization is a body that was created and was agreed upon by all the nations that, you know, you're going to empower this independent authority to regulate trade throughout, you know, the world. And all these companies, all these nations have done, including the United States, is continue to deprive the WTO of its power. And so you can correct China by empowering the WTO.
And China has really nurtured alliances all around the world, whether it's in various countries in Africa and South America. They have a lot of trade in South America. And so, you know, they can buy their soybeans elsewhere.
Brazil.
And in fact, that's what some of the soybean farmers who were interviewed, you know, in the market shows last night and this morning on NPR were saying, that, you know, we've spent the last 8 years nurturing these China markets and building up these China markets. I know the Apple market as well. And this will all now be gone because China can go other places.
Well, this new Silk Road concept that they've been pushing forward, this $1 trillion plan, obviously, you get people within
their true infrastructure plan.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
So will we pay more for edamame?
We're going to be paying a whole lot more, which I want to encourage my wife to listen to the news today, specifically as it relates to these trade wars, and let me get that TV now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're
okay.
Going
to...
What's the matter, Teresa? You don't like edamame?
Oh, no, I love edamame.
I'm a big fan.
But the soybeans are going the other way. Actually, in the U.S., the edamame prices are dropping precipitously.
Because?
Because
the marketplace is going to inflate
is
billing with volume.
U.S. farmers have been selling soybeans to the Chinese market, right? Mm-hmm. And they have expanded their sales. Their price has gone up because they have this whole new market that's opened up in the last decade or so. So now the Chinese are saying, well, no, you know, we're going to put huge tariffs on those. We're going to buy them elsewhere. So that drives the price down for soybeans. So you might pay in the short term less for soybeans, but it'll drive the soybean farmers out of farming, the smaller farmers out of farming.
Now, you know what we haven't talked about yet, Joe? I'm sorry to intervene here, but we have not yet talked about the fact that the news is filled with
Martin Luther King.
No, not only Martin Luther King, who is a great hero to so many of us and so important to this country, but also the fact that Mueller is apparently saying to the president, you are not a target right now. And it's extraordinary because that is a great disappointment to some people.
Let's just temper the enthusiasm that I think that the White House is probably feeling at the moment. You know, what you want a prosecutor to say to you is that you are a witness. So while it's important that he didn't say, you know, you're not a target, he also didn't say you're just a witness. You're a subject, which means, you know, over the next, month or so, if there's evidence to elevate that status from subject to target, that can happen.
Interesting.
Or if there's evidence out there that suggests, the man had nothing to do with it, and that can be independently corroborated, he would be a witness. But no one's saying he's just a witness right now. I guarantee you that if he were to sit with the prosecutors here and the investigators, that I guarantee you that status would change dramatically.
And that seems to be, isn't that they're using this as a possible
way
to get him,
calm him. Yeah.
Right.
And of course, you know, as I've been saying all along on this program, you know, there are things that are happening behind the scenes and we don't know about them.
Sure.
But you're seeing reactions take place. For example, Mr. Trump's a personal attorney who just decided to step away. Now, that looked like there was a difference in philosophy, but I think we now know the reason why he decided to step away. You have a client who refuses to take the advice of his counsel, and his counsel was saying, under no circumstances are you going to get into a room with these prosecutors and these investigators under oath. There is no way that I'm going to allow for you to do
that. Is that because he's a compulsive liar?
He's a compulsive liar, and there is... The reality is those investigators are not going to be walking into a room with you unless they have reviewed every shred of documents. They have reviewed every email. They have looked at every possible thing, and they're going to be asking you questions. And if the most intelligent people go into those interviews, there might be an oversight here or there. And when they come home and they review, you know, their information again, they will reach out immediately to those lawyers and say, hey, listen, I want to correct the record. There's something that I missed here. And they do that because they know that the ability for the federal government to pursue an action because you weren't truthful with them is, you know, quite honestly, it can happen. It happens frequently. To have a compulsive liar who thinks he's more intelligent than you walk into a room believing that he can somehow fool you, that would be a prosecutor's dream come true.
Is it of significance that story was the top story on the Washington Post and the New York Times didn't address?
I don't know that the status or the label, you know, is that newsworthy. I guess if you're one of those people who have been sitting back, you know, waiting for cuffs to be put on Trump, I guess it's significant. But I think given the fact that Mueller hasn't really articulated that he is just a witness and he's completely off the hook, I think that I don't know the
word witness. I'm interested in that. Does that mean, and then subject? So where are you going with that?
A witness is completely, you know, we're looking for you to provide us with information that will help support the investigation and the prosecution of someone else.
Yeah.
Like that's what a witness
Manafort.
Is. Manafort. Yeah. Okay. So that is the label that you want. You want to be coming in as a witness, right?
Right.
What you don't want is to be coming in as either a subject or a target.
Gotcha.
And there's a big distinction there.
Gotcha.
All right. Alan has letters. We'll finish up with those.
Let's just maybe spend a couple more seconds on Martin Luther King, Joe.
On the 50th?
Yeah. You know, this is a heck of an important guy in this country in terms of not only what he is as a spokesman for people of color, but also because he was the leader of a social revolution which talked about equality for everybody at the bottom of the social and economic scale. And that's what I loved about him. You know, when his whole thing, I don't think we're moving in this country the way we should be. That's for sure under this particular president. I think he would be appalled right now.
Well, you think about the incredible achievements that he did in his lifetime. And then you look at everything that we're hitting the 50th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy in June. And obviously then Richard Nixon's election later that fall. So, I mean, they have all the incidents and all the events happening this year. It makes us very reflective in terms of where this country's going and how can we actually correct this so therefore we don't repeat the mistakes of the past.
Well, you know, when I think about Martin Luther King and I think about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, I think about the fact that towards the end of the 19th century, what we had was a very significant case in this country called Plessy versus Ferguson. And Plessy versus Ferguson stood for the proposition of separate but equal. And from there, you know, the Jim Crow laws were born, and this country experienced, you know, one of the greatest, you know, of course, it's difficult to compare. You have slavery in one century, and then you have the Jim Crow laws in another.
Sure.
But certainly Martin Luther King represented this country's culture and resistance to that. And so it's very important to remember Martin Luther King for what he did in terms of waking this nation up, and then we got Brown v. Board. But Martin Luther King, you know, I think history tends to wrap him up in this bow, and with him, we believe that everything, you know, all of a sudden everything was right. But I think if you look at Martin Luther King's, you know, life as it was coming to an end, Martin Luther King was confronting all the other injustices, the economic injustices, sure, the wars, and the things that he was, I think, if there was going to be a phase two of Martin Luther King in that movement, it was going to be to tackle economic injustice. And here we are today with the byproduct of those issues being left you know, on the table and not being addressed correctly. Here we are in 2018, and we see a nation that is divided as a result of those inequalities.
We're going to end there. My thanks to everybody. Joe, thank you very much. David, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Teresa Bourgeois, thank you. We'll see you tomorrow. Alan, see you tomorrow as well. We'll be back right after this.